Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sense Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin our program today with an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 21st of July of this year. This article was written for the Wall Street Journal by Callum Borchers, and the title is Job Seekers Are Rethinking the One-Page Resume. Artificial intelligence robots read applications, and yours just might not contain enough information to impress them. The job seeker's gospel commands that a resume fit on a single page. It's now time to rethink that tenet as artificial intelligence screens more job applications. A one-pager is designed to highlight your credentials for busy hiring managers who will not take time to read a second page anyway. But there is no need to cater to a human glance if a bot is going to read your submission instantaneously. In fact, a longer resume these days can now increase the odds of getting through an initial interview by giving you more space for the relevant words and phrases AI is trained to spot. A couple-page resume that focuses predominantly on your impact in previous jobs is extremely important these days, said Hari Kolem, who is chief executive of AI recruiting software maker Findem. Findem combines resumes with public information like LinkedIn pages and intel on past employers to generate candidate profiles for clients. It tries to translate jargon into plain language, helpful for everyone and especially those with technical backgrounds like scientists and veterans. Partners include Recruit Military, which is loosening its one-page resume guidance. Kolem says applicants have to make themselves discoverable by feeding the AI tool enough info. If you're a job seeker with a single-page resume and an inbox full of automated rejection notices, you have permission to scream in rage at this news. Let it out, then start fleshing out that CV. A word of caution here, though. Don't get carried away. Some software can tell when you're playing keyword bingo. Plus, a person will probably look at your resume anyway if you get past the bot. Recruiters say they're generally willing to read multiple pages from an experienced candidate who made it through the AI screening, but 4 or 5 pages would be pushing it. Finding the sweet spot. Benjamin Keene learned this the hard way during a 6-month search for engineering jobs. He expanded his one-page resume to 5 and got little traction. My breakthrough came when I saw a listing where I matched everything in the job description, says Keene, who is 44 and who lives in Pennsylvania. I submitted my resume, the old resume, and I instantly got rejected. He hit the sweet spot, though, when he enlisted Microsoft's Copilot AI assistant to produce a 3-page version tailored to an open role at a financial services company. He got that job and started this month. Expanded resumes have long been the norm in academia and the federal government. They are a big change in many other lines of work as well. People are adjusting at different speeds. I touched off an internal debate when I asked the Brixton Group, a tech recruiting firm, about resume lengths. Sean Slater, an executive vice president, still prefers 1 page or maybe 2. I cringe at the long-winded resumes, he says. But Brendan Sobel, Brixton's chief recruiting officer, notes that hiring managers increasingly view resumes on smartphones. They have to scroll down to read even single-page submissions. In that sense, the number of pages is becoming a less relevant metric than clarity and structure, he says. Brixton Vice President Simon Key goes even further, though. While I can't speak for every industry, for the vast majority of technology professionals, I firmly believe the one-page resume is dead, he says. What's a job seeker to make of three opinions from one recruiting firm? The surest way to get it right in this evolving job market is to ask a recruiter's or a company's preference, assuming you can get a hold of a human being. Length done right. The single page rule remains practically set in stone for one group of applicants, those less than 5 years into their careers. Don't be the pretentious rookie who imagines such limited experience requires more room. Also, do your homework to determine whether or not a prospective employer is old school or well-resourced enough to deploy people on the front lines of resume reviews. McKinsey uses artificial intelligence at some stages of the hiring process, but not for initial resume screens, says Blair Ciesel, who is a partner who co-leads recruiting at the consulting firm. The people reading applications there typically expect a one-pager. It really does make you think about what matters the most, she says. That could mean expanding certain resume lines and leaving others off entirely. Traditionally, a resume lists a candidate's experience in reverse chronological order. Allie Andrus ditched that format when applying for sales roles in Chicago recently. She had a slew of internships and short-term jobs as a college student. But many of the businesses she did work for, including a salon, a custom t-shirt maker, and a dating app, had little to do with the positions she sought as a 26-year-old professional. And so Andrus limited her resume to her education and a single, long entry about the only full-time sales jobs she had held since graduating in 2021. She detailed her key performance indicators and her internal awards, which she logs in a computer folder that she calls her brag binder. Anytime I get praise or a shout out, I keep track of all of that so that when I update my resume, I have the numbers to back it up, Andrus said. She started a new job as an account executive earlier this month. In her case, adding length to the resume was more about beefing up an important section than tacking on another page. That's a good model for all of us. Artificial intelligence makes the rules fuzzy, but it is clear that length for its own sake is not the way to go. Today's resume should feature more of what's relevant to an open job and less of what is not. If it happens to run over a single page, that's increasingly okay. The next article that I would like to read for you today is taken from the New York Times, the 25th of June. Artificial intelligence does not have to mean the end of white-collar work. This article was written for the New York Times by Tim Wu. Instead of asking which future is coming, we should be asking instead which future we want. Tim Wu, who wrote this article, is a contributing opinion writer for this paper, and he is also a law professor at Columbia. He served on the National Economic Council as a special assistant to the president for competition and tech policy from 2021 to 2023. There has been a lot of talk in recent weeks about a white-collar bloodbath, a scenario in the near future in which many college-educated workers will be replaced by artificial intelligence programs that do their jobs faster and better. Dario Amodei, the chief executive of the AI company Anthropic, recently predicted that half of entry-level positions in fields such as law, consulting, and finance could meet this fate in just a few years. Mark Zuckerberg, chief executive of Meta, has predicted that AI will replace many of Meta's programmers within the next year or two. Optimists push back with a different prediction, though, forecasting that AI will not replace white-collar workers, but rather will serve as a tool that makes them more productive. Jensen Huang, the chief executive of the computer chip maker NVIDIA, has argued that you're not going to lose your job to an AI, but you are going to lose your job to someone who uses AI. Both sides in this debate are making the same mistake. They treat the question as one of fate rather than of choice. Instead of asking which future is coming, we should be asking instead which future we want, one in which humans are replaced or only augmented. The decision is going to depend on companies such as Anthropic and OpenAI and whether or not they want to build ethical, sustainable technologies, as they say they do. In that case, they should design artificial intelligence that will work hand in hand with humans rather than trying to build autonomous systems to replace us. Equally, if not more important, are the employers that adopt AI systems. If they really want productivity gains, they too must embrace AI programs that augment rather than replace. The distinction between augmentation and replacement can be subtle. Any technology from the stone axe onward replaces some human work in the course of augmenting it. The key question here is whether the tool enhances our abilities while still leaving us in control of how to use it. As Steve Jobs once put it, a computer can be a bicycle of the mind. Just as a word processor allows writers to write without having to laboriously correct and retype manuscripts, AI should help humans devote ourselves to our most significant and interesting challenges. A simple example is Copilot, an artificial intelligence tool offered by GitHub, an online service for computer programmers. When you write a line of code, Copilot suggests the next line of code, as with the autocomplete feature in texting. That can increase efficiency when the suggestion is indeed what you had in mind, and spark new ideas when the suggestion is not quite what you had in mind, while keeping the human user in the driver's seat. Another example is the artificial intelligence technology that helps radiologists do their job better by refining images, automating routine tasks, and flagging potential medical abnormalities. These are not autonomous systems that replace humans, as Jeffrey Hinton, a prominent AI scientist, predicted in 2016, they soon would be, but they rather are tools that make medical professionals better at their jobs. The augmentation approach to AI isn't just about preserving jobs, although that is important too. It's also about keeping human interest central to our future. That may seem like an obvious goal, yet it is alarmingly easy to lose sight of. All systems are vulnerable to mission drift when they gradually, often imperceptibly, diverge from their original purpose. But the risk is compounded if we allow autonomous AI systems to run the show. There also is a strong practical argument for the augmentation approach. It is to maintain the quality and the performance of the AI systems. For one thing, artificial intelligence systems rarely work well without human involvement. Consider the financial technology company Klarna, which last year boasted of automating its customer support, only to reverse itself this year and begin hiring back human beings. In addition, most AI systems are trained with data scraped from the web, much of which was created in the first place by humans. But if humans are cut out of the loop altogether, AI will increasingly be using data drawn from other artificial intelligence systems. And that is a problem. As recent scholarship shows, when artificial intelligence trains on the output of other AI, the quality of the outputs can quickly degrade, a phenomenon known as model collapse. That means, for example, that fully autonomous AI journalists, when posting to the web, would gradually pollute the data supply. This problem could be managed by humans, but unmanaged, it would be likely to undermine any gains in journalistic productivity. The risk of degradation goes both ways. Humans can atrophy too if they lack meaningful work. Numerous studies of the unemployed and of towns where factories have closed show major declines in mental and physical well-being. Augmentation is not any kind of panacea. In yielding greater efficiencies, it will lead to job loss. But that was also true of augmenting technologies such as the tractor and the personal computer, innovations that were worth their disruptive trade-offs. There is a world of difference between productivity gains and a systematic plan of industry eliminating unemployment. Indeed, as the economist David Autor argues, AI done right could help rebuild the middle class by giving a broader range of workers access to expertise, such as software coding, that is currently concentrated among higher skilled workers. It all depends on how the technology is used. In a classic 1960 paper, the computer scientist J.C.R. Licklider wrote that the present goal of computing should be man-computing symbiosis. That remains correct, man-computer symbiosis. Augmenting humanity has been the aim of technological development since at least the Bronze Age, and that should continue to be our goal, even as we develop technologies that mimic human intelligence. The wholesale replacement of human work makes for good science fiction, but a bad future. The next article that I would like to read for you today is from the Wall Street Journal, the 24th of June. The title of this article is "Americans Are Side Hustling Like We're in a Recession." This article was written for the journal by Callum Borchers. The two-job trend these days is about financial necessity, not pursuing a passion. Does your friend with a second job know something you don't? The share of working Americans holding down multiple jobs rose to between 5.3% and 5.5% during the first 5 months of the year. That's a range we haven't seen since the recession of the aughts, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Granted, almost anything from Lady Gaga to men's underwear these days can supposedly be a recession indicator. Leave the forecasting to influencers and economists. But whether an increase in second jobs portends a recession is only half the point. People are side hustling like we are already in one. It's a testament to our collective unease and further evidence that careers will look very different than they used to. Holding one job at a time is on the way to becoming antiquated or a luxury for emerging generations. Roughly 4 out of 10 millennials and Gen Zers have side jobs these days, according to new research by Deloitte. Elizabeth Faber, Deloitte's Global Chief People and Purpose Officer, says it's notable that the share of millennials working two jobs has been virtually unchanged for several years. People typically have less need for side hustles as they advance in their careers, but it isn't playing out that way for a group already scarred by two recessions. Those juggling more than one job say they are bracing for a potential downturn by padding their finances while they can. They are also ensuring that they'll still have a source of income in the event of a layoff or diminished earnings. I just started thinking, well, a recession might be coming. Maybe it's time to diversify, says Marie Incantera, who launched a cleaning business 6 months ago to supplement her main job as owner of a small public relations agency in New York. She has grown her PR shop to 2 employees and several freelancers over a decade in business, and she earns enough to live comfortably in Manhattan. But Incantera, 39 years of age, knows her services could be one of the first things that clients eliminate if they need to cut costs. After researching businesses that seem dull but reliable, laundromats, car washes, vending machines, she settled on cleaning because of low startup costs. She and a business partner book commercial and residential cleaning assignments and deploy gig workers to do the scrubbing, occasionally filling in when someone no-shows. Take a humble pill. What's most striking about Incontrera's choice of side hustle is that she had a cooler option. Before going into PR, she was a professional jazz musician. She could play the dive bar circuit for extra cash, but decided to be practical. The story of second jobs in this moment is not only about how many people are taking additional work, but also about what they are picking. In the past, we saw that many side hustles were driven by passion, but right now they're very much driven by necessity, says Priya Rathod, a spokeswoman for job search site Indeed. In a recent Indeed survey, 52% of respondents said they have side hustles to make ends meet, much higher than the Labor Department's figure. Rathod said that could be because the poll includes people who don't have 2 steady jobs, but occasionally drive for DoorDash or pick up freelance projects on Fiverr. Dinah Krigbaum works 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. as a development coordinator at a real estate firm in Arizona. She started nannying on nights and weekends this year. She makes enough at her day job to pay her bills, but is not willing to risk living paycheck to paycheck in the current economy. The roughly $800 a month she earns as a nanny is a safety net for her. Krigbaum, who is 30, used to babysit when she was a teenager. Now that she has a college degree, a white-collar career, and a child of her own, watching other people's kids feels a bit like going backwards. But it is a rare side hustle that checks 3 critical boxes. It pays well, fits around her primary job, and allows her to bring her son to work. One minute I'm meeting with consultants and investors, the next I'm talking to a 2-year-old, she says. Sometimes you just got to take a humble pill because you know it's the best thing for you. New normal. On a sunny afternoon last month, students at the University of California in Irvine pitched tents and business ideas on a campus green. It wasn't another Shark Tank-style contest for founders trying to build billion-dollar startups. Instead, the event was billed as a side hustle challenge and featured cookies, homemade sweatshirts, and eyebrow threading. Miriam Garg, a ventures consultant to UC Irvine's Entrepreneurship Center, says more colleges are preparing students for a world that may require them to work a second job. And it's often something completely different from what they are studying, she says. Alexa Gaxiola's degree is in business marketing, which she uses in her day job as a sales assistant and social media coordinator at an aerospace manufacturer in California. Her night job as a club DJ could hardly be further removed. Gaxiola, at 26, says practically everyone in her social circle works more than one job. If I know someone that has only one job, they're working overtime, she says. It's a survival thing. Her mix of a fun job and a staid one reminds me of how Hall of Fame baseball players once sold insurance or cars in the off-season. Recession or not, we may be headed back to a time when 2 jobs are the norm. Next, I'd like to read for you from a New York Times question-answer column written by Kwame Anthony Appiah. This is from the New York Times Magazine of the 29th of June. The question: I am leaving my job in a couple of months. I have about 1 month of sick days stored up, and I would like to count as my last month of work. This would allow me to continue to have health insurance and get paid for a month without actually working. My partner argues that this would be unethical and dishonest because I wouldn't be sick, as far as I can tell at this point. I argue that sick time is a benefit that the company has given me all the time I have worked here. Now that I am leaving the company, I have a use it or lose it mentality here. The company's policy on this matter is rather unclear. The response is, sick days are a peculiar currency in American office life. They accumulate in small piles like poker chips at a casino, but you're not meant to cash them in on your way out the door. Your firm seems to have an unusually generous policy with respect to the accrual of sick days. All the same, they are a contingent benefit. You get them only if you need them. You may tell yourself you've earned those days when you actually have earned only the right to draw on them when needed, not the right to turn them into a month-long victory lap. To use them when you're not ill, just because nobody's checking up on you, is to take advantage of a system based on trust. Use it or lose it, you say. But what you are proposing is more a case of use as abuse. There's the wider impact to consider, too. As a rule, when people are absent, their work doesn't simply disappear. It shifts to others. Every extra day you're gone can mean more emails, more tasks, and more pressure for those still on the job. If you need time off for health-related reasons, take it. But that's not a license to burn through every last day simply because you can. A reputation for leaving others in the lurch may stick around longer than you do. This is all we have time for on our program on careers today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.